Hello, welcome to the Amputee Comics Podcast, episode 366. My name is David Brook. I'm here to talk comics with my good friend Chris Copeland, master extraordinaire of interviews, editing my interviews, editing the AFPT's team's interviews, writing reviews, eating food three or four times, sometimes eight times a day.
Eight times, yeah. They're very small meals, so I have to like keep adding to the pile.
This is your second week, so you'll be off for 2 weeks. Is there any final words you'd like to say before we get into the episode, before you shove off?
I don't like the Cheez-Its that are like twice baked. Those are not good.
Yeah. Whenever they mess with the Cheez-Its, they made like chips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, don't do that. It's weird.
Yeah, and then some of the flavors have been weird. There was this one flavor. It was like a queso flavor like 5 years ago. I was addicted to, and then they stopped making it. But the real burning question all of our listeners are wondering is, do you like James Bond, and which one is your favorite?
I'm going to say Pierce Brosnan is the best. Whoa. James Bond. Yeah. Is that controversial at all? Is that?
Well, considering what's going on in the news with him. No, I'm just kidding.
I was like, oh, no.
No. I mean, we grew up with Goldeneye. I mean, we were at the right age for
it. I did, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not like I said Roger Moore.
Well, you know, they all have their own pros and cons.
Do they?
But this is actually the Amputee Comics Podcast, where we talk about our favorite comics every week. And this week we have a huge guest on, a huge prize,
Brosnan.
Present. It's like a really good interview with Joe Kelly, the Amazing Spider-Man writer. And I'm trying to convey this as like a present or gift because I convinced Chris to do a 7-part interview series with Joe, but you're going to hear all 7 parts at the end of this show. So if you are one of the people who actually is a fan of our show, you don't have to wait for the next 5 parts because you'll get it all in this episode.
Or just consume all of it and your knowledge will
be
that much greater because that's how it works.
I talked to Joe way back in April last year, so it's almost been a year, and we talk about that a little bit, but we're kind of getting into the groove here with his ASM run. We talk about Death Spiral, the upcoming event. We talk about all the new characters he's introduced, like Plague RX, and I get a couple good teases in there about what to expect going forward, including Amazing Spider-Man 1000. So stay tuned for that interview. It's a big one, really good one. But before we get to the interview, let's recap the news of the week. And this week, Marvel came out swinging with a couple solicitation drops, including the entire X-Men line getting the full solicitation treatment on AFPTComics.com. Check out the art. There's plenty of covers to check out for Moonstar, Magic Colossus, Inglorious X-Force, Generation X. I could just keep going on. But there's some revelations in here as far as information in the summaries. Cyclops is going full Cable mode with a humongous gun rig that I've never seen. I don't know how he's going to operate that when he's blind, but I don't know.
Stranger things have happened.
This is true. Anything pique your interest here?
I mean, that Cyclops cover is amazing. I also really like the Inglorious X-Force. I think that's really cool looking.
It is. So over on X-Men Monday, back on Monday of this week, it was this cover for Storm, Earth's Mightiest Mutant, number 4, was revealed. And in it, we see Storm has a daughter. Say, what? Got that. A lot of people talking about that this week. It also looks like Gambit's going full monster mode. If you've read the last issue of Uncanny X-Men, I guess Morbius and his Morbin friends, fully morbed Gambit.
Morbin out. They morbed out.
To give him wings and whatnot. The next issue of Uncanny's next week, I guess we'll figure out what's going on there. In some more solicitation news, Marvel dropped solicits for Venom and Null that are coming out in June and May. And these are pretty big because both characters are getting brand new costumes. So post-Death Spiral, the big event, apparently their costumes are worn out, they're welcome, and then now they're going to have these new costumes, including some design sheets that we get to see on amputeecomics.com. But the Null cover is particularly story-spoiling in that he is white, no longer black. And that is because he is entering some sort of light dimension, which is actually a creation of Steve Orlando, the Light Force dimension specifically.
I want to know what you think about the rehashed Venom, because I know you have strong thoughts about Venom's current look, and I want to know what you think.
Yeah, so if you check out the art, you'll see that Mary Jane has her full red locks coming out of the top of her head, but then still has the straight teeth and a much more bodysuit style costume here. And as someone who's been curating the Venom Unleashed column for a year, I can tell you that people have been asking nonstop, why doesn't she have boobs? Why is she so masculine? And there was a story reason for that. But I guess all those people complaining were heard, because they've decided to make her more feminine looking with this new costume. And the gold chest plate thing is more like wraps in a sense. And she also has slight heels, which...
Yes, a little kitten heel. I was going to say that. That's very...
That is very 90s.
I like the giant, because you could never tell that it was her, which I thought was sort of the whole point all along, is that she would...
Hiding her identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Superhero 101.
Not anymore, though.
Yeah. Now so everybody knows.
Al Ewing did say this represents Mary Jane leveling up with Venom and becoming more enmeshed. Yeah, sure. You know, Venom's already been powered up with this new gold look. We actually were talking about that in Venom Unleashed this week. Someone was asking, why gold? Well, that's part of the reason why Venom is more powerful. And I guess the threats are going to be a lot bigger. So it's been very much a street level book since Al Ewing took over. And I guess they're going to shift into a more heavy hitter book going forward. He's also writing the Null book. And he's just the leader of symbiotes at this point. Given Hela took Null's power, I guess this is a big spoiler that instead of getting it back, he's going to go to the other side. He was the dark side, now he's the light side. It's worth noting the Light Force dimension's very new. Orlando wrote it in a...
Super new.
He introduced it, I forget the artist's name, apologies, in a Marvel Unlimited book, which was only like a couple years ago. And I'm going to talk to him about that. I'm talking to him in a couple days, actually. I'm going to ask him about that.
Sounds like you're going to yell at him about it.
Why'd you ruin my favorite character, Null? Everyone's favorite character is Null.
It's Marvel's greatest creation.
Well, everyone knows Chris Copeland's favorite comic book story arc, including indie comics, is Brand New Day. And he is so excited for Dan Slott to be coming back to Marvel to write more spectacular Spider-Man comics.
Wait, you're being sarcastic, but it's kind of up there. It's almost, this is almost 100% the truth.
So a little history, Brand New Day, basically Spider-Man became a weekly comic, which was freaking insane.
Super awesome.
And I was a big fan at the time, and personal story, I got into the letters page, but only because I knew my chances were high, because they had to fill the letters page every week. And so I actually showed Discord and I put it on socials on Friday about this. But it was a fun time. It introduced new characters. And it appears from this cover that one of the new characters that Dan Slott co-created is back, Mr. Negative. But the story will highly connect to Kingpin's infrastructure control because of his thing called the Lexicon.
I'm very excited. I mean, to go piggyback what you were saying, like Brand New Day just felt like a shot in the arm and was like still very accessible, but it was also kind of like next level. So I'm excited for this a lot.
It was also an era where they kind of tried to go back to Peter having a lot of friends and stuff.
Yeah.
So there were lots of different connections. And
yeah, his life was a lot busier, I think.
Since Nick Spencer's run and partly Dan Slott's run, it's really become... so insulated or siloed with Peter kind of doing everything on his own. So it'll be interesting to see if the supporting cast comes in. Abrams Comics Art decided to reveal their supporting cast for their fall 2026 lineup with AIPT. We exclusively revealed their solicitations. There were a couple books that already were announced elsewhere, like Alex Ross's Marvel Dimensions, which is continuing his relationship with them. He did a fantastic, excellently drawn Fantastic Four book with Abrams, I think 2 years ago now. There's a lot of interesting stuff in these solicits. Abrams comics art's fairly new, but some of these books here, I think they're going after the Fantagraphics kind of audience with a Don Quixote adaptation, for instance, that looked really interesting. They're continuing to produce Mutz comic strips in collected format. They've got a Dune Messiah graphic novel that looks pretty neat. And they have a whole manga, a side project label. And there's some cool stuff in there. So if you go to aptcomics.com, you can see the full list along with lots of cover art. Is anything wet your whistle on this one?
I mean, I'm excited for that Don Quixote thing. I also just, in general, like the Abrams books, from what I've seen and gathered, they're really high quality and I like them a lot. So I'm glad that they seem to be like doubling down on the things that they do best.
Mm-hmm. This seems like a lot more titles than usual for them too.
Yeah. I feel like they're really like hyping the amount, because usually I feel like they've been a little more select, but they have the same kind of general palette that they explore. But this is, yeah, it's just so much bigger.
Moving on to some indie comics news. There is a new 3-issue G.I. Joe story arc coming out in May. Joshua Williamson is still headlining this one. I say that like he shouldn't be, but...
Get out, Williamson!
I didn't mean it like that. Andrea Milana is joining him on this one. They did the Cobra Commander solo series together. And I've never been a huge G.I. Joe guy, except for the action figures as a little kid. So I'm not quite sure how important it is that this character Risk turns evil or something in this. I don't know. Are you familiar with Risk?
I am in the same boat as you that I didn't really get into G.I. Joe at all, but like the Williamson stuff has brought me in, and I feel like he, as good as his other stuff is, especially with DC, like I feel like Joe is where he like hit his stride in a major way. But yeah, I don't know enough about Risk to discern if this is huge news.
The biggest part of this is that it's definitely going into a horror side of things, which Williamson is
super interesting. Yeah,
he's done quite a bit of, so it's not like he's new to the game. Also in the news, DC announced You're a Superhero, lifting up heroes in everyday life. It's a young adult graphic novel. It's a 72-pager, actually not even young adult, ages 5 to 7, that was announced, coming out in November. There's only a cover to check out, but I'm glad that DC continues to try to market to younger audiences. They had that Zoom label that kind of lasted a year or maybe a year and a half, and then it
disappeared. Yeah, if that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of their young, their kid stuff, their young adult stuff, I feel like is really unsung in a lot of ways, so I'm glad that they're doing more.
And then in some incel angry news, Summer of Supergirl taking over for Summer of Superman. Last year it was Summer of Superman. Now it's Summer of Supergirl for obvious synergy reasons because of the film, of course. But DC doesn't just do a limp look at the synergy. They actually go pretty hardcore on these. And they've got a ton of offerings, including facsimile reprints for the first introduction of Supergirl and also Superman. There is, of course, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, the Supergirl World, which is co-created by, well, not co-created, it's an anthology from creators around the globe, and that'll be released globally all on the same day. There is plenty of reprints. There's a compendium from DC Comics as well. Just lots of ways to celebrate Superman.
And Supergirl. I love it. I mean, I get that it is probably like a cash grab because the movie's coming out or whatever, like you said, like at least they're not being lazy. They could just be kind of like half cock with this whole thing, but they genuinely try and do some cool things. And I think those facsimiles are going to be super cool.
And Superman Day is on April 18th this year. Have you already decided? You already took the day off, I'm sure.
I ordered a cake and everything. I took the day off, cleared my calendar.
Excellent. It's sort of like Batman Day, and it's like it does feel like a Hallmark holiday in a way. They need to get the what they need to do is start petitioning a U.S. president to make it a national
holiday. Yeah, let's do this. Let's make it a real, if we're going to do it, let's do it all the way.
I mean, they've already started greasing the wheels. They've got coins from the U.S. Mint being made, right?
Or maybe just don't yell at me if I take the day, if I take a sick day off. Like, at least can we just meet me halfway?
Could you imagine you get in the next day and your boss is like, I know, it was Superman Day.
You're like, no, I had a chest cold.
Also in DC Comics news, the Absolute Batman number 18 cover was revealed by Lunar on Thursday afternoon. Scott Snyder didn't want it to be revealed before his issue 17 came out next week because it does spoil some things. And I don't know how deep we have to get into spoilers, but one biggie is the cover reveals the Absolute Court of Owls. Surprised?
Why would I be?
I mean, it is Scott Snyder writing it.
Yeah.
I will say the first Batman story arc was like all Black Mask. And then the second story arc was all Bane. And now it feels like we're speedrunning characters and villains.
Yeah, it does feel, I don't want to say it feels forced, but yeah, it does feel like maybe, I wonder if it's they're trying to like increase things up the pace a little just because of how insane it is. And like, you know, we've talked about in the last week or so, some issues are on their 10th or 11th run. And so like, it makes sense to me of like, you know, let's get this momentum while we can and just cram everything all at once.
Right.
It's not been bad compared to the other arcs, but it definitely is like busier for sure.
It's an interesting change of pace, I would argue.
Yeah.
Because it has been so methodical for, you know, 15 issues.
Very deliberate.
I mean, obviously Mr. Freeze was in there and obviously the creation of Penguin, Two-Face and Riddler was kind of spilling out of the Bane story arc, but now we're getting Court of Owls, Poison Ivy. Obviously, Penguin, Riddler, and Two-Face are going to start evolving once they get healed enough to leave the hospital. I don't know. It's interesting. Like, I can't imagine being Scott Snyder and being like, well, it's working so well, but then I have to start introducing new rogues. So what am I supposed to do? Yeah, anyway. And our last bit of news, IDW revealed IDW Crime, a new label joining their IDW Dark Horror label, along with three series that are announced, Seven Wives, Killer Influences, and Fixation. It's cool to see IDW continue to like branch out. I saw some news earlier this week from Bleeding Cool that creator-owned doesn't really exist anymore at IDW. They want to own the original stories, so I wonder if this is part of that, these crime books, but your opinion on that could vary.
I think it's just interesting that like the two major kind of trends in comics have been horror and then crime, and I can applaud IDW enough to be, you know, really ahead of the curve, or at least with the curve to some degree, and like really doubling down on both of those.
Yeah, I had said to you in Discord, like, what's next, IDW sci-fi? What did you say? It was like IDW Godzilla? Well, you said something like that.
I think I said fantasy. I made some
fantasy.
Joke.
Fantasy. Oh, you said ogres and wenches or something.
Yes, ogres and swords. Yeah, yeah.
That's IDW was positioned as IDW Dark was a huge success, so thus this was created. Actually, we had some other IDW exclusives on Friday, including some ash cans they'll be showing at Comics Pro for some two of their IDW Dark series you should check out. And yeah, they are movers and shakers right now. Moving on our next segment, Top Books of the Week, our top two favorite comics out this week. These are the books that rose to the top. Sometimes it's hard because we read so many books and I'm like, I don't know what I want to pick. But for my second pick, I went with Absolute Wonder Woman 2026 Annual by Kelly Thompson and Matea De Lewis. And this one is gorgeously drawn. No surprise there. And as an annual, it is a one-shot style story where you can jump in and enjoy it. But I think it did a couple things really, really well. For starters, it opened showing how Wonder Woman is saving the day across the globe. So she's not like Batman just sitting in one city. She's literally saving lives in a variety of ways, too. Like fighting villains, but also saving people from floods, which I thought was really cool. Intercut with that, though, was her pleading to Athena to help her with something. And that something is the adventure in this issue, and it involves Medusa. And at the core of all of this, it really hammers home Wonder Woman's tenacity to never give up on anyone and to fight as long and as hard as it takes because she believes in something, which is kind of fascinating to me because this is the Dark Side universe and it's supposed to be the darker, more negative kind of point of view on these heroes. And yet she still is very much entrenched in that goodness.
I think it speaks to her circumstances are darker. I think the things that she's dealing with are darker, but yeah, I mean, she's very much that persistent kind of light in the dark, which again, feels like no matter where you take the character, that's, you have that core. That's the thing that works. That's the thing that makes Wonder Woman.
Right. That's
so
true.
Interesting.
That's
true.
Boil her
impressive.
Down. That's what she is.
Yeah.
There are some impressive gods in this. Athena is so cool and so well designed. Actually, Thompson revealed on our Substack earlier this week that Hayden Sherman designed the character, but Matea did an incredible job with the visuals on that. And I think, you know, annuals sometimes can just be these like throwaway one-shots that anyone can pick up, but I feel like there's stuff in here that will matter later in the main story as well.
Yeah, and I think it connects back to the, kind of early part of this run where, you know, the whole... her having to like become Medusa or use Medusa's abilities to like save Gateway. So it felt very throwaway, but it's grounded in a really specific way that it doesn't feel like, complete fluff. It's not, there's layers to it. I liked it because if I had ignored all my kind of other readings of Wonder Woman, I still would have really enjoyed this one and still would have felt like, oh, I know exactly kind of what this version of the character is all about.
Right. And that's important in annuals. But what was your second favorite book of the week?
My second favorite book of the week was Jar Jar number one.
I don't know if that's the official title.
I was going to call it Jar Jar's Big Adventure, but I decided not to for a number of reasons.
Sure.
You and I have talked about this book. We have made jokes about it, but
For weeks.
Yes. I genuinely loved it. I thought it was so exciting. I thought they took this character, they maintained kind of what everybody knows about him, which is that he is stupid and a little annoying, but also he does have like a good heart and he's trying to make a difference. And they kind of present that in a really interesting way. And they give him an opportunity to go on an adventure and be a part of the kind of grander Star Wars universe. And it's thrilling and slightly touching and a little funny. And it's just like everything that I think I want in a Star Wars book. And I think they did a really good job. There's a million different universes where this book could be stupid, could have been completely different, but I just think that it worked on so many levels. And I'm genuinely excited to see what comes next.
I didn't like it that much, but
you did not like it.
I found it kind of pointless, but I will say it wasn't silly. That's for sure. He wasn't like a dum-dum in this. Like he was in the prequel.
He's a little bit of a dum-dum, just the right amount of dum-dum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just still bitter that he's not a Dark Lord in disguise. I feel like they can still pull this off.
Yeah, maybe there's another trilogy. They have a few issues. Yeah, I think there's five.
No, I mean the movies, baby. I mean the movies.
Oh, let's do it here.
Rey versus Jar Jar. Let's get it going, baby.
Do it.
My favorite book of the week was Mark Spector, Moon Knight number one by Jen McKay and Devmalia Pramanik. I've dug Jed's Moon Knight runs, plural, because there's been like four, I think, at this point.
There's been five or six, yeah.
For some reason, they decided to continue to reboot Moon Knight, probably because of sales, but also because Marvel seems to have a mandate. No issues go past 10. But this is an interesting character that a lot of primo writers have taken up this character and done, some might say, like the epitome of Moon Knight because of the multiple identities and his disorder, dissociative identity disorder. And this issue, instead of like having him, Moon Knight, in control of his faculties, we open right in basically a prison that I think a lot of us can relate to because it's an office space prison. And all he's doing is delivering mail. He doesn't know who he is. He's being manipulated through fear powers. and a manager that really doesn't like him. And so, you know, really early on, we realize he's in this like cubicle prison. And the issue does a couple things that are really fascinating to me. One was there's this like new personality that Mark has created via a television. And it's like this cartoon Moon Knight that's kind of peppy and fun and positive, but also like, let's murder. Like he's like, thumbs up. And I'm wondering if that character, like, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, it's like, it's his Batmite, it almost felt like.
I said that in my review. I said the exact thing in my review. Did.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
And I love it. I hope it continues because it's a fun little weird wrinkle to Moon Knight's already weirdness. And then at the same time, this is almost a one-shot style story because we get to see him, you know, subjugated and then ready to be freed at the end and back in his faculties. So between that and like the moody, like almost noir style art with lots of shadows, I was just here for this story. I really liked it. And it also, of course, builds on what Jed's been building for years now. But I think it's also accessible for a casual reader because when Moon Knight is out of sorts and doesn't know which personality he even is, that's kind of like the core of what the how the character usually functions really well.
Yeah, that conflict. I will say that I did like this for most of the same reasons that you said, but also I think that I'm glad that Jed MacKay is getting a chance to like really spend some time with his character and get kind of different opportunities, different storylines to kind of move him through. And, you know, I think when given that opportunity, like with this one, you get some really interesting stuff.
Yeah. I can't remember a writer writing one character like this for so long at Marvel or even DC.
Yeah.
Well, DC, you could say Mark Waid for a lot of things, but.
True. But I mean, Marvel at least recently. Yeah. Yeah.
Especially with Marvel's, you know, inability to go past 10 issues. I sound so bitter about that.
You're so angry about it.
I bring it up in the middle of the night. I wake up at 2 a.m. and I turn to my partner. I'm like, 10 issues? That's not enough. That was also in the news this week. Popfirst was like, Infernal Hulk canceled. And then Philip Kennedy Johnson and Nick Klein were like, no, it's not. This was the plan.
I promise you, everything is going according to plan. Yeah.
I really liked your number one pick. I was tempted to put it on my top two, but I'm glad you put it on there.
I went with Cyclops number one by Alex Pecnadel and Roge Antonio. Again, this is like another one I feel like we've talked about to some extent, maybe not as obsessively about Jar Jar, but like I'm a Cyclops hater. I have been for years and like, kind of slowly started to warm up to the guy. And I feel like this one could maybe push me over. I just think that, you know, we get a story that maybe is removed from the context of Cyclops a little. Like if you haven't kept track of kind of Krakoa and, you know, everything in the last maybe year or so kind of post Krakoa, you can still kind of enjoy the story. I think it kind of speaks to the heart of Cyclops is that he's just, you know, I forget what somebody calls him in the beginning of the issue, but it's such a perfect nickname that I think just kind of speaks to his, like, you know, he's like, always a Boy Scout, but he's getting kind of like edgier and darker, and he's kind of stepping into this new role, and he's really growing and evolving, I think, in real time and doing some interesting things. And you just get like a great story of like what happens when this guy whose entire life has been dedicated to controlling his powers and never being kind of out of control and feeling like he can always help people, like he is lost control of his powers, he has lost the ability to sort of be in charge, and like what happens to that person and like how do they survive and how do they deal with threats, and you know, can they overcome their own sort of, you know, self-doubt and insecurities. And it's just such a great issue, and I think, you know, the art is amazing. I think it nails the kind of like gritty like survival story element that is such a huge part of this. But then I just think Alex's characterization of Scott is just really great, and it feels like an earnest celebration of the character. He really admires kind of who Cyclops is and what he kind of represents, and he wants to like push that character and make him kind of question himself and do it in a way that feels really interesting and kind of novel. And so it's weird for me to be like overly enthusiastic about a Cyclops book, but I mean this was really good, and I'm I have an idea of kind of what's going to happen next, but I think that maybe this one could surprise me.
Yeah, I like the inclusion of the Reavers too. Pagnidel has some roots in horror, and it's nice to see like that horror side of things come into the play as well.
Mm-hmm.
I saw
body horror. Love it.
You interviewed Pagnidel, and you boldly started the interview with "I hate Cyclops" or something like that.
I did. I was like, I dislike this man.
And like, I remember,
and he was a great sport about it.
I'm sure he was. Yeah, because obviously, when you're talking to someone, if you did that like in an email, maybe it wouldn't work out. An email interview. Hey, by the way, hey Cyclops, want to do an interview with me?
Hey.
No, but I remember a couple of people on social were like, "Well, I'm not reading this interview then," and I was like, "Oh, that's so sad. Why don't we just read the second sentence?"
You lost out. I'm sorry.
No, yeah, I think it's a really exciting start. It's interesting. Like Cyclops has had a couple solo series already before this, and every time it feels really big. Like, oh wow, Cyclops series. I think because he is like he is a team leader. You don't usually expect him to have a solo series where it's all about him.
Yeah, they don't bring him out on his own enough. And so I think people associate him with like just X-Men books. But
right.
I mean, people love him. And this one proves that, you know, he can kind of stand on his own, divorced from the context and, you know, history of X-Men stories.
You know, our top books, I'm starting to wonder, why can't we have a Moon Knight Cyclops like team up book? That'd be kind of crazy.
That would be weird. It could be good. Could be weird.
It would be interesting to see like Scott trying to get Mark to do what he says, and Mark's just like running.
It's like, no, yeah, I got it. I already got this plan figured out. Thanks, bud.
What is that meme where he throws all the moon arrows and he's like, "Fuck this bullshit" or something like that?
I do.
Bunch of bullshit.
I think I had that on a t-shirt. Yeah, I think I had that on a t-shirt.
Moving on to our next segment, Standout.
Oh, pow.
Moment of the week, our favorite panel page. Oh, my God. There's so much good stuff to check out and look at every week. I always have a hard time with the Kapow because I'm like, should I just go full gore, like someone's eye being gouged out?
Or yeah, I'm almost always like, I got to find the worst possible thing that'll make somebody uncomfortable.
We used to have a column on AIPT. It literally highlighted only the gross stuff every week.
Oh, damn. I missed out on that.
Yeah, what was that called? I forget now. Oh, Panels in Poor Taste. That was what it was called.
Mm.
Yeah.
Maybe we bring that back.
Maybe. It was a full team effort, too. It was like six different people. But my page, double page layout, comes from a Wade Wilson Deadpool number one by Ben Percy and Jeff Shaw. I really love this page. It's Deadpool's captions are kind of going through the motions of all the pain and suffering he's gone through lately or in the past. And I just love the montage of these horrible murders. And Jeff and Ben, whoever concocted the murders, wow, like you really came up with some clever, different kinds of kills. We got him getting electrocuted in the top left. If you can't see, if you're listening to this, go to amputeecomics.com. We have the art there. We have Deadpool getting split in half by Colossus, and his spine is like showing, which is really gross. Another one where he's diving into a bunch of spikes. That's got to hurt. Carnage splitting him in half. The always favorite, watching one of those hydraulic presses crush things, but it's his head this time. And then him with a thumbs up like Terminator going into a meat grinder, or no, not a meat grinder, it's a like a compactor for a dump. And I don't know why Vulture is there, but anyway. I think it really hammers home all the suffering Deadpool's gone through, and this was close to my top two as well, because I thought Ben Percy did a really good job with like a subtle, the pain inside Wade is worse than ever. And he actually wants to die. He wants to feel pain because of something he did involving his daughter. And so he feels like in a darker place than he's been in a long time. So this is an interesting reminder of like the fun he has when he dies. And this is a whole issue. He's just like literally like diving into bullets to feel something.
I will say the only thing that like I do love this page. I think it's great. But to me, the one where he's like diving into the spike, it looks like he's not being murdered so much as he's committing suicide. So
the way he's diving, yeah.
Yeah, that's so graceful, so elegant.
There is a dude there, but yeah, I don't even know if that's actually an in-canon moment. It's probably just something.
Yeah.
A lot of these are in canon. Like I think the Colossus one has happened. Carnage, maybe. Anyway, what was your favorite panel or page?
My favorite page was from A Star Called the Sun by Simon Roy, which is his kind of collection of assorted stories from his unofficial universe, which is, you know, featured or included, you know, Habitat and Grizz Grobus, which is, I think, another kind of smaller collection. But, when I interviewed him a few weeks ago, we spent a lot of time talking about kind of how Simon develops his world, how he thinks about kind of design, how he, you know, melds different kind of sci-fi elements, and how he kind of considers like real world stuff, you know, from the 60s with like manufacturing, and like how he makes that cool and interesting and building this kind of universe. And I feel like just this page is just so cool about, you know, it feels like a snapshot of how he approaches storytelling and using design. And it's just such a great kind of like, you know, snapshot. Again, you've got kind of the weirdish sci-fi, you've got kind of the, you know, the people centric aspects of it, and how like a lot of these technologies, and just for the sake of, let me make a cool robot, it's, you know, trying to have like people have tools to, you know, build on worlds and, you know, survive in these. Like, yeah, it's all functional in a huge way. Contrasted, I think, with kind of that, you know, the top half of the page is, you know, it feels like it could be like a propaganda ad from some weird, you know,
or like sci-fi Kryptonians.
Yeah, absolutely. The same kind of like, look at that. Look how beautiful and romantic, you know, space travel is compared to kind of, you know, the nitty gritty of it, which I think is a thing that he, you know, does really well. I think he inspires through his design work, and everything kind of feels really cool and interesting and novel. But it's, again, it's all about kind of in service of exploring people and relationships and what it is to actually kind of like contribute to society, and how do societies get built, and how do they kind of proliferate, and all these things. And it just looks cool. And I, you know, everything kind of about this book is really revealing about kind of how he works as an artist, and how he kind of considers comics and design work and marrying that. And this page just feels like, you know, kind of the tip of the iceberg. And yeah. I would recommend, yeah, even if you've never read Habitat or Grizz Grobus or anything, like, I think this book is like a super great introduction to what I think is maybe one of the coolest people kind of working in sci-fi comics right now, and someone who does continually interesting things.
High praise.
Yes. The highest.
The haters will say he paid you to say that.
Mm.
Moving on to our next segment, top books for next week, our most anticipated comics out next week. Man, I need to switch to yours, because I flipped through the freaking thing, and I was this is the coolest book ever.
You were showing me like spoiler pages, and I'm like, no, stop. I don't want any part of this.
So I had a taste of that, but I also had a taste of my pick, Absolute Batman number 17, by Scott Snyder and Eric. I'm gonna butcher your last name, Canetti? Canet?
Canet.
This is part one of a two-part Poison Ivy story arc. And once again, it's great to see Batman not as Batman. He's Bruce in a couple of scenes here. And I think the introduction of Poison Ivy is a tantamount one. She's definitely one of the biggest rogues there are. And, you know, it's pretty obvious every villain is a horror thing. And it continues with this. And I'm really excited to see how folks react to this, let alone the Court of Owls, which we talked about earlier in the show.
Yes, we did.
What did you pick?
My pick. Are you ready? I'm just going to say the title and that's it. I'm not going to say anything else about it. I'm just going to say the title.
All right.
The Florida Hippopotamus Cocaine Massacre, number one.
Wow. Incredible.
That was a mic drop. That was me dropping the mic.
The art is so good, and
it's so bonkers. It just looks so amazing.
It reminds me of like Jeff Shaw in a way. It's not quite the same, but it's like the level of detail
in that bubble. Yeah.
It's like, wow, this is the artist is insane. This is an insane person. Moving on to our next segment, Judging by the Cover, Junior, our favorite cover art coming out next week. Looking ahead to what's to come, what was your favorite cover of the week?
I picked It's Jeff Meets Daredevil number one, just because he gives Matt Murdock shark teeth, and I can't think of anything that makes me happier. There it is. I'm so overjoyed.
It's pretty incredible. Obviously, it's an homage to Jaws by Nick Klein.
Yes, absolutely. Which there's a lot of homages to Jaws that don't work, but this one is like spot on, tonally perfect.
This might be the most homaged cover or a poster ever.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Absolutely. So it's got to be up there.
It is interesting. Daredevil's the one attacking the shark, but I think that's the joke, isn't it?
Right. And if you have to explain a joke, that makes it even funnier.
There's also a great lettering at the bottom, like a movie poster, which is a nice touch.
I do love that. Yeah, yeah.
My cover comes from Lee Bermejo for, I forget the number, Amazing Spider-Man number 22. So
yes.
If you don't know, Lee's been doing, I think he's been doing this for about 6 months, 7 months now. It's all covers that are leading up to issue 1000. And Lee Bermejo is doing some of the most realistic looking art he has been doing for years now. And okay, we've seen the symbiote kind of get around or kind of, you know, hug Spider-Man, cover him. And we see that here in this cover. But a couple things really struck me. Not only are we in the bell tower, which is a great touch, but the way we can see the eyes of Venom coming up around his head.
Yes.
I don't know if I've ever seen that before. That's a really interesting touch.
Yeah, it makes him look like an actual suit. Like it's a fully formed suit just coming on to Spider-Man.
And then like the goopiness on the leg and arms as it's enveloping his really shiny, cool looking suit. Bermejo is always very good at, as you know from like his work on Joker and Lex Luthor.
Yes.
The textures of the costume to make it look really like something you'd wear around the neck is a really nice touch. It's going to be cool when they eventually collect all these covers. I don't think they've ever said this outright, but for Batman, or was it Detective Comics, he did a series of covers for over a year.
Yes.
And it was a story. And I wonder if that's happening again here in some way.
I really hope. Yeah. That I think it might've been Detective that he was doing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah.
And then they collected it in a one shot. But yeah.
It was super cool.
These are our covers of the week. So next up, Joe Kelly joins the show to unpack his almost year of writing Amazing Spider-Man. Considering he does ship bi-weekly, it's over a year of writing. But yeah, we get into Hellgate, Plague RX, whether or not Spider-Man should be dating people or not. We don't talk about Paul, so don't worry about that. Joe, thank you so much for chatting with me again. Almost a year since the launch of Amazing Spider-Man under your belt.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thanks for having me back. I'm glad it's our almost anniversary.
Yeah, yeah.
We're still chugging along.
So much has happened in almost a year of ASM. You've got Hallucinations, Hellgate, the clone mantle of Spider-Man under Norman complications, and then of course the cosmic element, which I honestly, speaking personally, don't want ever to end. I love the dynamic of all the characters. You're doing a fantastic job there.
Oh, thank you.
At the same time, you keep returning to identity, I feel like, with, you know, who Peter is, who wears the mask, what Spider-Man means to other people. Was that always the core of your plan, or did the run central theme reveal itself as you built each storyline?
No, it was definitely the plan up top. You know, I try to the best of my ability, structure these arcs in a way that there's some sort of thematic underpinnings, right? And so like the first arc was to set up Peter's biggest fear, really, ultimately, right? This fear of loss and where it kind of comes from.
Yeah.
And that's why we did the childhood stuff and sort of set all that up with Hobgoblin. And then, of course, then we make him lose everything with Hellgate, right? It's like, let's see what happens, you know, when his worst fear comes true.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was, okay, now we've got these two parallel tracks. Who is Spider-Man when he's not in his element?
Mm-hmm.
So who is Peter when he's off by himself? Is he still Spider-Man, quote unquote? And then what does Spider-Man mean to other people? So, you know, taking on that identity, messing around with the identity of Peter and the identity of Spidey in general, Norman trying to figure himself out, and obviously Ben, you know, whose relationship to identity is very complicated. So yeah, that was always the plan. And now it's kind of all coming to fruition, which is great.
I think a part of all of this that people sometimes forget is with a bi-weekly book, you need two artists working in tandem. When I talked to Zeb Wells last, when he was on ASM, like he talked about, sometimes it was hard because he was writing a book that's 3 months away, 2 months away, you know, 4 months, mm-hmm. different artists. And I think you've been doing that impeccably. And the split between cosmic and earth fighting is helpful too, I'm sure, to keep your mind straight on who's drawing what.
Yeah, that definitely helps. And you know, again, that was something, it was an experiment for sure. We thought, you know, typically, obviously we do as long an arc as possible with one artist, so the other artist has time to then work. Mm-hmm. So you're sort of just leapfrogging that way. And then we're like, hey, this is crazy. What if they both came out essentially every month? Mm-hmm. Could we build in enough time? And it, you know, obviously had its challenges, but it was a really cool way to try to divvy up the work. And and it was really fun because the flavors are so different, right? I mean, like, right. Pepe and the cosmic stuff was just sort of a perfect fit. He loves doing these wild environments and these new designs and stuff. And then having, you know, JR Jr. on the street stuff and Norman especially, because I really love the way he draws Norman. I just think he brings so much weight to him. You know, that stuff worked really great. So now, you know, now that it's finally kind of winding down and, you know, we'll see how things go. I'm definitely writing, I think, 4 arcs at the moment.
Oh my gosh.
Like, in terms of jumping, because again, just trying to figure it all out and
right.
what works for people's schedules and coming off of the holidays, you know, all that stuff. So mm-hmm. it's all good. I mean, it's not a complaint, but it can be a challenging way to work.
As part of you, it probably won't be collected like Pepe stuff, Romita stuff. Does part of you want to have it collected so it's just all Romita in 6 issues or whatever, and then Pepe in another 6?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't like, there's advantages to both, mm-hmm. but because we tried to do like the Peter's narration while he's on Earth, like right after Hellgate, mm-hmm. is the narration that he's actually doing in space, mm-hmm. right? So if we split them up completely, it might not jibe correctly. So I'll actually be curious to see how that plays out for everybody. I imagine they're going to put them the way they were built, mm-hmm. but I'm not totally sure. That said, it would be awesome to just, you know, let each story breathe on its own, kind of a, you know, a remix.
Yeah, it would be a neat.
How do you watch it?
It's like a whole new experience of reading.
Yeah.
A big through line for the series has been Peter's youth and the traumas he's kind of faced. And then more recently, we've seen Norman and some of his trauma. What made you want to excavate these specific eras of Peter's past? And what do you feel it reveals about adult Peter that we don't always get to see?
For Peter specifically, it was kind of, I thought it was fun to go pre-high school. You know, it's just this idea of exploring. It's really, we've never looked at it. It's like we saw him get dropped off as a baby, and then we see sort of high school Peter. Right. So this sort of middle age, or middle school rather, not middle age. Middle school Peter is fascinating to me because I think that's a time where all, you know, we're starting to bubble up our emotions in new ways, right? Like, mm-hmm. puberty's kicking in, you're starting to figure out like, oh yeah, I'm not quite a kid, but I don't know what I am yet. Yeah, I mean, it's a very challenging period of time. And you know, when you look back at those early Spider-Man issues, Peter was angry a lot. Like, he got very angry,
right,
really quickly. And so I just wanted to sort of go, well, where does that kind of come from? You know, and it seemed pretty obvious that it was him acknowledging like, oh, I, you know, I'm adopted. I don't, you know anything about my parents, like just sort of the frustration of that. And then the realization that one day, you know, Aunt May and Uncle Ben won't be around. Mm-hmm. And that's scary. And what, you know, seeing him lash out as opposed to just being chill Peter felt like it was really ripe ground. And, you know, I know it can be a little, it's a lot false to just go, oh, like that one thing that happened to you when you were 13, you know.
Oh, sure.
Determines the course of your life. I mean, that's just what we see in movies and TV shows and
right,
stuff.
But right.
But it is a fun way to look at it. And so then to apply that same lens to Norman, mm-hmm. almost to sort of imply that like when you're Spider-Man, when you're like swinging around, your present is informed by your past, like no matter what. So for Norman to have to confront those things and to get to see the sort of side of what happens when you're, you know, raised in an abusive household and what that really means and how that infiltrates his life as he's trying to be a better person mm-hmm. felt like really good Grissom.
Yeah. And, you know, it's been a minute for now since Norman's, you know, sins have been removed and he continues on this path. We've got this upcoming book where he seems to be training other spider characters, which when that was announced, I was like, oh my God, it was seeded by Joe because you had that those spider characters like Silk and whatnot confront Norman and be like, you need to stop wearing this costume, which I thought was a nice touch. It's all all building towards something. It's not just...
You would almost think that we planned some of this stuff out.
I know.
Yeah, well, like you were asking before about jumping around and like, you know, Zeb was saying, the only way you can do it is to have kind of a plan. Like I've done it where you sort of just do the full tight wire act and you just hope it'll work out.
Yep.
I hate that. It like keeps me awake at night.
Oh, I bet.
So I like knowing at least... In this window, this is happening. In this window, this is happening. Mm-hmm. To give a general guide. And then, you know, the sort of, the story's 2 issues, the story's 3 issues, this one's 5. Then that doesn't matter as much. Then you sort of figure it out. But yeah, we do try to plan ahead, you know, as much as possible.
Right, and you can see that for sure. When it comes to Pete's voice, I just love how you write the dialogue here. You know, he's the anxious humor, the scramble thinking. You know, obviously the moral compass of it all, especially some of these threads in the cosmic side of the storyline. Do you have a non-negotiable for Spider-Man's dialogue, especially when he's scared or outmatched?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, you know, I definitely try to go back to the, you know, when does Peter use humor thing that Stan used to say, you know, I mean, it's just using humor as a shield, not a weapon, is really interesting. So, trying to put humor in as much as possible when it's appropriate, but I really like that he's got a switch. You know, like I don't think Spider-Man should be super dark. You know, like there has to be a reason why it would get dark. But he does have to have a line where all of a sudden it's like the jokes stop, you know, because things have gotten really serious. And I think that also conveys to the reader, it's like, oh, okay, like we're not making jokes about Hellgate. Like, this is not cool. And so, yeah, I don't know if that answers the question, but it's just, I don't know. I just, he's so earnest and he so wants to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like he tries really hard not to lie. Mm-hmm. And then when he does, because he has to lie all the time, especially to May, you know, it hurts. And he's conflicted, and that's a good use of the sort of internal monologue stuff, you know.
Totally.
Not quite ready to bring back thought balloons, but
maybe. I guess some fans would love that. It's so funny how it's so you know, what's it, passe? I don't know. It's so out of form these days, and when it does show up, people are like, oh, my youth.
And it's funny because when you look at like you know, I read a lot of manga, they use thoughts all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, they do. It's slightly different. It may not be a literal balloon. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's balloonless, right? It's just sort of floating internal stuff. I love that. So I don't know why we don't do it more often. But obviously, the captions kind of cover up.
That's true.
But,
that's true.
That should be a little more florid, I think.
Again, we're only a little less than a year into your run here, and you've introduced Hellgate. You've introduced, I'm going to butcher this name, Kintsugi?
Kintsugi, yeah.
Thank you. And then Plague RX, which the second I saw the design of that, I was like, oh my God, I need to know who this guy is. And you paired him with Tombstone and used him to sort of escalate the sense that Peter's absence is creating openings, I feel like, in the NRC. What is Plague RX's core concept, and what does he represent in the ecosystem of this run?
Oh, I really, you know, I love Tombstone as the kingpin, essentially, right? I mean, it's fun that he is sort of running street level crime, but he's a smart dude, and he knows that like you can't just fight superheroes with machine guns, right? Like it's not going to work. So he's interested in amping up the roster. So, you know, he's works with that Doc Trauma, who's a character that we introduced a long time ago, but she's popped up in other things. And it's just sort of amping up the crew. So yeah, Plague RX is this the doctor. Like he literally will take care of people and he can heal you. You know, he's a healer, but the side effect of that power is he holds on to it. Mm-hmm. And then it's got to go somewhere, which for a gangster is kind of awesome. Mm. And we get to see that in full effect when he unleashes on you know, on Norman Spider-Man.
It's like a different form of Bishop now that I think about it. That's interesting. And then Kutsugi, this young hero with a shield. I love how he's been sprinkled in. Like, again, you've been planning this all along. You know, how consciously are you using that idea as a lens for Peter and the use of this character?
Yeah, well, I loved putting him with Norman, right? Norman Spider-Man.
Right.
Because he doesn't know, for you know, who he's talking to. It's just Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. And he is this very, like, oh, gosh, I'm here to help, right? Like, that's his literal, like, catchphrase. I'm here to help.
Right.
And he wants to do good. And he's just a kid with a shield. And, you know, the Kintsugi concept is this Japanese art form where it's you things that are broken, you sort of fill the cracks with gold, and it makes them both beautiful and stronger. And it's sort of acknowledging, like, flaws make us powerful. Mm-hmm. And the reason he sort of chooses that name will become evident soon.
Oh, cool.
And so, you know, the goal was to kind of give him some runway, get to see how he interacts in this crazy world, because he really doesn't have powers, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And mess around, especially, again, pitting Norman with just young people is great, you know. And pretty soon we'll see, you know, we'll get to know a little bit more about this kid and why I brought him along for the ride. And then it'll be fun when he finally gets to meet, like, proper Peter and what that does. I think 28 is when they'll cross paths for the first time.
Sweet.
Sometimes I forget the numbers, but yeah, I think that's it.
I love the fact that Peter's got some romance going on the side and the cosmic side of things. Do you have like extra I don't know, worry or thought planning when it comes to something like this? Because the MJ of it all, and the people out there who want MJ to be in a relationship with Peter always.
Yeah, I mean, anytime there's anything that even smacks of romance, it's that celestial body looms large. You know, like we talk about, there's just sort of a gravity. But I try to, you know, I want it to be fun. I want, you know, there are readers that are new to this.
That's true.
You know, they only know, or even if they're not new, I mean, they've been broken up for a long time. So, you know, you could have been a reader for the last 10, 15 years. And all of a sudden it's like, you only know them apart. You know, that they were together.
Good point.
But even, you know, even with that, like Ray, it's funny, Raylith was going to be a much more heavily romantic character. Mm-hmm. And then she evolved into something different.
Oh, interesting.
You know, like I love her, like just her level of innocence and innocence at the same time, she's like suffered dramatically, you know, in her life. And they see something in each other, but it's more akin to a friendship, I think, than a romance. I mean, we'll see. But she's also so, so earnest, like in ways that like Peter isn't even used to, because she's spent an entire lifetime being repressed. So to have somebody that makes her feel so safe, all the feelings come out, and maybe too much, and which is a really fun character. And I just, you know, Pepe's design for her and the way she looks and when she fights, like that issue 17 is one of my absolute favorite things. I mean, it's, you know, when he's letting her be her, and then when she finally breaks her, you know, essentially her programming, to stand in the face of these people that are essentially her slavers, that, oh man, that was some good stuff. I was really happy about that.
Those alien raptors were unreal too. And
yeah. Yeah, well, that's Pepe doing that classic thing the artists do where it's like, I have to draw a lot of these things, so I'll try to keep them simple. And then you see what he drew, and it's like, oh, dude.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is simple? Yeah. And then the fact that she's tied to Hellgate was a big surprise for me. And this Nicodemu character of the Pinnacle.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. And this deeper sense of a cosmic threat, but also the steel silk. Of it all. Was this something that was the steel sick element? Was that pitched? Was that your original pitch at the start, or is that something that evolved?
Yeah. So, you know, Nicodemu, I mean, what we've seen so far is that she's had some sort of prophecy, you know, and she's a seer, and she believes that there's some important relationship between the Hellgate and this Prince of Steel Silk. You know, what exactly that means and what it's going to turn into, mm-hmm. we'll find out. But she needs them to be together, hence guiding Hellgate to Earth.
Right.
But Hellgate's a pretty loose cannon. Like he's, you know, and there, that whole society, it's a caste system, and he is full of ego because he believes he's the top of the pile. Mm-hmm. And so they've kind of created a monster, you know, but they do need him for something specific. I mean, they're trying to heal their planet.
Right.
But whether or not he can listen to Peter long enough to do that, we'll see.
Interesting. Yeah, you're taking Spider-Man in places I never thought it would go, which is, I think, is the most exciting part of all of this. But we do have to have crossovers, which is a very big part of the big two, especially. Death Spiral is looming. I think it starts end of February. From your perspective, what is Spider-Man's emotional pressure point heading into this event?
Oh, yeah. He'll be back from space. I don't think that'll be a big surprise to anybody. You know, we're pretty much getting, I'm not sure which issue is actually out at the moment, but we're, you know, that's getting wrapped up. And Peter will be back, and, you know, he has to try to put his life in order and figure out what's what. I mean, there's been two people running around posing as him. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know what sort of havoc was wreaked. There's problems at Rand. There's problems in his personal life. There's Spider-Man problems, you know, all stuff that was out of his control. So he's got to come home and deal with that. And then almost immediately he finds out, you know, he's been gone, right? And people have been trying to contact him. Mm-hmm. And Ben has not really dealt with much of that.
Right.
So, you know, when he finally gets his phone,
there's
messages and texts and all these things. Mm-hmm. And one of those messages sort of sets him off when he realizes, like, very, very bad things are afoot in Death Spiral. And, yeah, it's not going to be great. I mean, he's already feeling a little bit disconnected, a little insecure, very much like he has to be stronger. Mm-hmm. You know, like, this is something that is driving him forward. And then he comes face to face with a nightmare scenario.
Right, and he doesn't even know MJ's Venom yet, which is another
huge bombshell. Although she thinks that he knows, which will be
quite funny. Because you had that interaction between her and Ben, and she didn't know there was a clone running around at that point.
Yeah, so her and Venom are not very happy with Spider-Man.
Oh man, I love all that melodrama of it all. That's exciting. And then you've got Carnage in it too, who knows Spider-Man's identity.
Yeah, well, and I didn't remember actually just in the pacing of things that was that. I mean, that's the thing that once, you know, it's like, just imagine when you're gone for a trip, you're trying to get all your act together. So it's that times 10,000. And then one of the messages is, oh, by the way, Carnage knows. And like, wait, what?
Yeah, yeah.
That's bad. That is the nightmare scenario. So it's going to be a pretty hectic time for
so,
Peter.
So what I'm getting here is that this all is building off of that anxiety you have after getting off vacation.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's like, oh man, I got to pay bills and get back to work. Yeah. Oh, and a serial killer might be after me.
Now, when it comes to the event, did you have like a round table with Charles Soule and Al Ewing? And how did that function? And I'm sure there was a collaboration as far as how the event might play out too.
Yeah, absolutely. We would meet together periodically, sort of between Marvel summits and then getting just on calls and trying to pace out the story at large. You know, Charles and Al have obviously been setting up a ton of stuff in their books as well. And I think because what Charles was doing in Carnage with sort of the hunting of serial killers, really was great fodder for like, oh, well, if that became, you know, what happens when one of those serial killers is, you know, big enough to sort of go toe to toe with our guys, kind of laid the groundwork for this. So yeah, and working with them has been great. I mean, everybody's very generous with ideas and really having fun, I think, with these characters. And we honed in a lot on family, which is perfect for, you know, any spider book, but just thinking about the web of the families between, you know, Pete, MJ, and Eddie in their weird way. Then mm-hmm. obviously the symbiote families, and they all have relationships with these characters in different ways. It made for like, okay, this is where we're going to start, like family and what ties are important and what ties are chosen, you know, chosen family versus born family. All that stuff is really the groundwork for, you know, this very, this one is a pretty dark, pretty dark.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. It's 8 parts, I think. Plus the, they just announced another one shot to, I think Charles is writing about Torment's origin.
Yep.
Everyone on AIPT's Discord thinks it's Shocker behind the suit because he has like padding, but I won't ask you who it is or not.
I will not say.
When you approach an event like this, you know you have to have the big swings and stuff, but are you also in the back of your mind going, how does this inform the things I'm building in my own solo ongoing series?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the nice things was that, you know, we did... The first piece we did about this was for Free Comic Book Day over, I don't remember if it was a year ago or before that. I guess it was a year ago. And you know, we were just barely starting to cook at that point.
Right.
So this was already kind of built into the schedule, even kind of as I took over the book. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like, all right, when does this space stuff time out? Oh, a month before the crossover? Great. And we just had to figure it out. So laying the tracks in, you know, the things that we were just discussing before about like what Peter's about in space, what really matters to him, what's important, trying to figure those things out. And then how will that feed directly into this story? And then what comes right after? All those threads are in there. You know, it's really important for me personally, and I think for all writers, like nobody likes a crossover to be foisted on them. That's like the worst thing, right? Totally. You're figuring out a story and then you're like, oh wait, now I have to, everyone's pink and we're going to do something ridiculous for 2 months. Like, okay.
Let's pause all the stuff I was doing so that we can have a silly fight comic or whatever is happening.
Right. Exactly. If you don't get to sort of thread that in, it can be painful. So I think we all, actually, I feel pretty confident in saying that everybody had good character threads that they were able to pull across the crossover.
Yeah,
that are going to be meaningful for the books going forward.
Nice.
I can say for sure, like there are a bunch of things that happen in this that have ramifications down the road. I think it's going to be really surprising on a lot of levels.
Ooh. Jordan D. White, the editor, has teased a few things in Venom Unleashed is in regard to Death Spiral. I can see a lot of folks are getting pretty excited for it. And it's funny, it feels like it's been marketed for like months, but we're still like, as of this conversation, like 4 weeks away from it or 3 weeks away from it. Could you tease one thing for me? Is there an emotional thing that fans should brace for in this event? Yes. As far as Spider-Man.
I think, I mean, there's a lot of emotion in this book in this crossover for sure. And I think that, we are going to be introduced to something in this book that will change the course of, this is going to sound very grand. That's what we have to do on these things. Make grand proclamations. Something's going to definitely rock Peter's world. I think everybody's world is going to get rocked quite a bit, but Peter's world specifically is going to get rocked. And some stuff happens here that we will see pay off as we get on the road to issue 1000.
Yes. That is looming large. Have you finished the script for that yet?
No, I'm starting it this week, actually.
Ooh, exciting.
Yeah.
It's
I mean, I know what's happening. Yeah.
You just remembered this morning.
Yeah, so that's good.
You had a little note on your computer. Hey, start writing exactly. ASM 1000. That's huge. That's going to
That's part of the funny, you know, jumping around part, is it's sort of like there's a bunch of short arcs leading up to that just because of runway and and Pepe, etc. So it's sort of like getting ahead to him. I had to make sure some of these other ones were done first.
Right.
Then I'll jump ahead, then I'll go back. You know, it's classic, but because that's September is when 1000 hits, I believe.
Historic. DC's had a couple 1,000s at this point, so thank God Marvel gets one finally.
Yeah, yeah. It's really exciting. I think it's going to be very fun. And again, hopefully, you know, will be the kind of book that is exciting as a jumping on point if people are just sort of curious, mm-hmm. but very much a payoff to stuff that we've been doing. And of course, you know, just you can't sort of have an anniversary without just acknowledging incredible history, and especially something like 1,000. So it's got a little bit of everything, but
nice.
But very clear story. And then there's going to also be a lot of other stories and features, right.
backups,
and all that stuff, which I don't even know about. I'm just focused on my thing. I'm
that's big enough as it is. Yeah. So do you have like a locked in outline for it, and then you write to that? That you like? Does Nick Lowe like approve that outline or something? How does that function?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it quite a bit, actually. Gotcha. The last time we had a Marvel Summit was about 6 months ago. And, you know, we were starting to talk about it then. And that was sort of an in-the-room conversation of like, hey, this is what we're thinking about, and this is the type of thing, even nice. Though it was very early. And we had some initial ideas that were thematically cool, but maybe the execution was not as interesting as we hoped. So that got mm-hmm. scuttled. And then kind of came up with some other stuff, you know, in part because of people. You mentioned melodrama before.
Yeah.
Like, I am a sucker for melodrama in comics. I mean, I think it's critical. And I think I don't remember if we talked about this last time, but it's like, we've spent so long and so much time in our industry being like, no, we're so cool. Like, we have to be cool.
Right,
and
right.
To the point where almost people don't want that stuff. Or
sure.
They do want it. Sure. But we buck against it and think that it's somehow corny.
Mm.
We need that stuff. Like, these are big emotions and big feelings, and we want them articulated physically.
Mm-hmm.
So making, you know, somebody has sort of pointed out in the room, like, well, what's the big melodrama that's going to happen in this thing? And that actually really helped hone in on, you know, what the story would be. And I really do think it's going to shock people.
Ooh. That's great.
Yeah, it starts in Death Spiral, and it sort of leads up. So
okay,
we'll there's some, I think, very fun stuff coming, and I think it's going to be very challenging for Peter in a personal way. Like, this is more personal stuff probably than super stuff.
And that's the part of your arcs that the flashbacks are just, as a longtime reader, and the first comic ever was a Spider-Man was Amazing Spider-Man. Seeing these new elements of Peter's youth and like helping us inform the human behind it all has just been the most exciting element for me as a longtime reader.
Oh, that's cool. It means a lot.
This has got to be the biggest year of Spider-Man, and you're at the helm. We've got Spider-Man, Superman crossovers. We've got Death Spiral, an event, Spider 1000. How does it feel?
Oh, it's been crazy. it's really been wonderful. I mean, it's completely coincidental, and I'm just very happy to get to be the guy in the chair, you know, driving the bus at this particular point, you know, because it's a year in either direction, it's somebody else. I mean, it's just just very lucky, and just have a lot of gratitude and certainly feeling the pressure. I want to deliver, and I want people to just have a great time. And I hope the thing that I've been really try, I guess, when you talk about the sort of non-negotiables before about Peter, it's like, I love this stuff. Like, I really, I love Spider-Man has always been my absolute favorite character, superhero, you know, from the time I was a child. And so to be able to contribute to the sort of canon is already an honor.
Mm-hmm.
And I just try to do it in a way that it feels heartfelt. Like, that's my whole thing. Like, I'm happy to throw my guts on the page, you know, and you know, like, there have been stories that have things that are directly pulled from my life.
Sure.
And especially some of these flashback stories, you know. Mm. So I find that stuff really important, because Spider-Man has been so woven through my life to put my stuff in there.
Your DNA.
In a way, obviously.
Hmm? Your DNA.
Yeah, to put the DNA and not just have it be, you know, obviously the craft is not just doing like self-insert and being like, okay, this violates the character.
Right.
But it really, you know, taking some of these things that were meaningful to me and going, how do I weave this into Peter's life? Like right. That for me is the most important part. It's when things just start feel like, oh, it's all punchy, punchy. Mm. It could be cool. Yeah. Like there's cool to that.
Sure.
But it feels a little hollow to me. And so it's like, where can I get the guts? And obviously the dials have to get modulated every month. You can't just be like, oh, I'm just going to, you know, bloodlet and do all my emo Peter all the time. It's got to go up and down. But it all comes from a, you know, place of love and what I hope is honesty. So,
well, you're definitely building a legacy here that I think people will remember for sure.
Oh, well, thank you. I hope so.
We recently lost Sal Buscema, whose work helped define Spider-Man. I think physically, I mean, for me, Spectacular Spider-Man was so iconic, the darkness of it, the edginess of it. As someone contributing to Spidey's evolving legacy, what does Sal Buscema's influence mean to you, either directly or indirectly, as a Spider-Man storyteller?
It's so interesting. I mean, it's like, I mean, just I think back to these comics, these, you know, dog-eared books that I was given as a kid, right? And he, you know, drew a lot of them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they were meaningful books to me. And then I got to meet him, you know, and know him just as a person on really my first international trip ever, like as a creator. And he was a very, very sweet man. Like, just could not have been nicer. And it was, I think it was the first time I was really involved in a situation where I was like, oh, I'm meeting like a proper legend and hanging out with him. Like, not just a quick, I was lucky enough to meet some very cool people in the offices at Marvel. And it would just be very fast, like, oh my God, you know, that's so-and-so, or this is so-and-so.
Sure, sure.
Some of those people I got to know a little bit better, like Klaus Janson could not have been a nicer human being to me as a new person, you know, new guy at Marvel. Like,
yeah,
such a sweetheart. But that's what Sal was like, you know, and just could not have been nicer. And that trip was really special for, you know, for everybody. So
that's great.
So yeah, I'll always cherish that. But yeah, I mean, he's, you know, giant. He's
totally giant. For sure. Yeah. Before we go, is there any other projects you wanted to plug outside of Spider-Man?
the only thing that's, you know, Spidey keeps me very busy, and I'm very, very grateful for that. The one thing that I'm super excited about that happens to be, across the street is the, I did get to contribute to the Mad DC
crossover. Oh God, the fans are losing their minds over the creators on that. And Chip is editing it, or guest editing it.
Yes. Chip was kind enough to ask me to do it. And even more kinder, I said, is there any chance that I could draw it?
No.
And he said yes. And so I got to draw this thing, and he very graciously inked me. So he made it better.
Oh, wow.
He
that's
embellished awesome. It. But yeah, I'm very excited about it. It's such a silly thing. It's just a one page gag, but I'm just, it's very exciting to go, oh yeah, I get to have, after, you know, 30 years in comics,
yeah,
like a page I drew. So that's very
huge.
Exciting. But Matt, yeah, otherwise.
It's a story. Yeah. I mean, it's important. It's an institution.
Oh God. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, I can't even tell you how many of those Mad digests I burned through, you know, especially again as a kid. And just that stuff is burned into my brain. So, you know, when Chip asked about it, I was, you know, absolutely hell yes, you know, what, and if my drawing is so abysmal, you can't deal fine, just throw it out and get it to a friend of yours who can draw. Like, it was, but it was super fun. I think it's going to be a really,
well, knowing story. That you're drawing it too, has piqued my interest even more. It's not like you just contributed a one page script or something. That's very exciting. Have you drawn before? I'm not aware.
No, just for fun. Like I way back in the day, the goal was, you know, oh yeah, I want to draw comics one day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I went to college, not really an art school, but I was studying art and theater, and honestly, mostly studied bourbon and beer, and did not really do such a hot job.
Sure.
And then I wound up really more focused on writing, and it was a little bit easier for me, and I I let the art degree go and I focused on writing. But I've always loved visual art. I by no means would consider myself an artist, but I can fire it up. You know, when somebody's like, "Oh yeah, you have 3 months to draw a single page."
Oh, okay, yeah, sure.
I was able to sort of very slowly work my way into it. So, but it was good. It really it reignited, you know, my sort of love of
being forced to put pen to page in a different way. You're like, "Oh man, yeah. I put my artist through hell. Why am I doing this?"
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that definitely happened. I definitely got to have the moment of like, "What the hell was I thinking?" When I asked for this crowd scene, or you know,
right, that's funny,
like some stuff, and then some things that really worked, which I was pretty impressed by. But you know, the being able to draw digitally mm-hmm. also makes your life so much easier. I mean, it's
for sure
you can fall into the trap of infinitely hitting undo and then you never finish anything,
right?
That's mm-hmm. true,
that's true.
But going, okay, you know, like I don't fully trust my hand, so let's go for, you know, a panel, but it's the size of the iPad.
Sure.
That makes life a lot easier.
Sure. I'm really excited to see that. We've got Death Spiral coming out later this month. Amazing Spider-Man 21 is out this week. And thanks so much for your time, Joe. This is always enlightening.
Oh, absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.